Well, thank you, Henry, and welcome to you all. I'm not going to mention all the names here. I'd have to go through the whole crowd. This is quite a day for me. It's actually the third chair that I've occupied. The first two, the Eugene Higgins Professorship of Physics and the Thomas Jones Professorship of Mathematical Physics, I held at Princeton University. But this one is very different and very special. First of all, at Princeton, I never got a real chair. Only the title. So thanks, Fred, for the real chair. And second of all, I never actually met Eugene Higgins or Thomas Jones. And although it was a great honor to occupy these chairs, it was an impersonal honor. This chair is very different. It, of course, has great significance for the KITP. It will certainly help us recruit and retain future and even present directors of the KITP, support their research, and further the activities of the Institute. But for me, on a personal level, it has a much greater significance. For me, it is a sign of Fred Gluck's respect for me and his faith in my plans. Fred was the first person that I turned to help me in my efforts to raise an endowment and to help with the extension of our building for the then ITP. His advice, his creative ideas, his enthusiastic support have been totally crucial to our successes to date, particularly in the successful effort that led to Fred Kovely's extraordinary gift to the Institute. So for Fred's enormous generosity and his untiring efforts on our behalf, and for his and Linda's personal friendship to Jackie and to me, I'm deeply and eternally grateful and very proud to be the first occupant of the Frederick W. Gluck Professorship of Theoretical Physics. Thank you, Fred. Okay. The story begins in Berkeley, where I arrived as a graduate student in 1962. And Berkeley at that time was the center of elementary particle physics. Berkeley was the site of the biggest machine, the biggest accelerator that existed at that time in the world. At that time it seemed enormous, today it seems puny. This is a picture of the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory at the University of California at Berkeley, which until a few years ago was more famous than Santa Barbara as being a center for physics. This is the Bevatron, seated on the top of the Berkeley Hills, overlooking the fogged-in bay. And it was the primary accelerator that probed the structure of elementary particles. Elementary particle physics was the study of the fundamental constituents of matter and their interactions. And for a potential theorist like me, it was obviously the problem to work on. This was the area that attacked the most fundamental problems in science, in my opinion, and the mysteries were the greatest. Very exciting for a young student. Berkeley in general was a very exciting place at this time, but especially in physics. Now, the study of the fundamental constituents of matter had been going on for many millennia. Its basic principles were enunciated by Democritus in 400 before the year 400 before Christ, when he said that by convention there is color, by convention sweetness, by convention bitterness, but in reality there are atoms and space. Well, that was a very foresightful remark, and physics for the next 2.5 millennia confirmed that idea. The ordinary matter, which possessed sweetness and color like a flower, was realized to be made out of point-like atoms, just as Democritus predicted. And in the 20th century, the atom started to get disentangled. Atoms, originally thought to be point-like billiard ball objects, were realized to have structure of their own. And in the beginning of the last century, the internal structure of the atom was resolved and understood. The electric, small point-like electric charges that revolve in the atom, the electrons were discovered, and then the nucleus was discovered. And that is going to be the subject of my talk, the structure and forces that govern the behavior of the nucleus of atoms, which were realized soon after to be made out of nucleons, neutrons and protons. So this is the prologue. Let's go a bit more into the prologue. The atom, the structure of the atom emerged in the early part of the 20th century. It was understood to have this charged nucleus and electrons, which were of the opposite charge, revolving in some sense about them. The elucidation of the structure of the atom played an important role, a crucial role, in arriving at our modern theory of physics, which is based on quantum mechanics. But the basic law that governed the structure of atoms went back to the 19th century. It was simply electricity. The force that held together the electron and the nucleus was simply the electric force. But in modern physics, this was understood in different ways. And one of the modern concepts of the electric force is that it's due to the exchange of a particle, the quantum of the electromagnetic field. And in the quantum theory of electrodynamics, which was developed as quantum mechanics was developed, and through the middle of the 20th century, one indeed arrived at an extraordinarily good understanding of atomic physics. The theory that was used to do this, quantum electrodynamics, the quantum mechanical theory of electromagnetism, is actually, from our point of view, the point of view of today, an extremely simple theory. And that's why people were able to use it to such great precision. It is simple partly because it is linear. Photons, light rays, do not interact. They're neutral and don't experience electric forces themselves. So that if you pass two laser beams, shoot two laser beams at each other, they do not scatter. They do not interact. Unlike in Star Wars, where you have these laser beam guns. And the other reason quantum electrodynamics, this theory of the atom, was simple was that the strength of the electric force is very weak. And measured in dimensionless units, it's the coupling, the strength of the force is very small, 1 over 137. And when something is small like that, you can treat it as an arbitrarily small number and do what physicists call perturbation theory. You can neglect corrections that are of order alpha squared. Life gets easy. You can do calculations. You can compare with experiment. And that was the case in the theory of the atom. That was the case in quantum electrodynamics. And by the time I came on, all of this was very well understood. However, the nucleus was not. The nucleus was discovered in 1911 by Rutherford. What Rutherford did was the first scattering experiment. He wanted to probe the structure of the atom and see what it was made out of. And at that time, the theory, prevailing theory, was that the atom was a diffuse cloud of charge, jellium. And the electrons were embedded in this diffuse cloud of positive charge. And what Rutherford did was scatter alpha particles, which themselves are the nuclei of helium atoms, at the extremely high energy of the time of 6 million electron volts, at gold atoms. And what he expected was that the helium atoms would recoil, would go through and be slightly deflected by this cloud of charge, and the helium, the nucleus, the gold nucleus would recoil a bit. What he found instead was that when he scattered the alpha particles, they recoiled often at large angles. As he remarked, it was almost as if you had fired a 15-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you. So he didn't, this was very surprising. And it took him a while, but Rutherford was not just a brilliant experimentalist, he also had theoretical ability. He realized that this could be solved if you assumed that the atom had within it a very small, point-like, very heavy nucleus where all the positive charge was located. And that sometimes the alpha particles would have head-on collisions with the nucleus and could bounce back at large angles. Here's another illustration of this. See, the alpha particles came in along different possible trajectories. Those out here would be deflected only a little bit, but if you came in right at the gold nucleus, you could be reflected even right back at you. And what Rutherford managed to do was calculate the various probabilities for these different things to happen based on the assumption that there was this point-like nucleus and that the force between the incoming alpha particles and the nucleus was just the electric force. And it agreed with experiment. So that established the existence of a point-like nucleus inside the atom. The atom is about a hundredth of a millionth of a centimeter across. It's pretty small. But the nucleus is 100,000 times smaller. Now, when the nucleus was first deduced this way by Rutherford, it was totally unclear what was inside this point-like nucleus. You couldn't see within it. And it took, in fact, almost 20 years before the constituents of the nucleus were understood to be first the proton, 1919, and then the neutron as late as 1931. So physics sometimes takes a long time to develop before, unless you have the relevant technological ability to carry out experiments to proceed to the next stage. But what was the force between the nucleons, between the proton and neutron that held them together inside the nucleus? Well, here there was no classical theory to build on. Whatever the force was, it was new. It had nothing to do with electricity and magnetism. It was much stronger. So where did it come from? There was really no guidance. And the first brilliant idea was that of the Japanese physicist Yukawa, who said, well, the way we think about electricity nowadays is that we have this quanta of the electromagnetic field, the photon, that's exchanged between charged particles. So maybe the force between the proton and the neutron is due to the quanta of a different field that nobody's ever heard of, but let's postulate it. Call it the meson, and we have this particle, which is like the photon, the pion. But Yukawa understood that there's a connection between the mass of the quanta of the particle and the range of the force. Now, electromagnetism, electricity, is a long-range force, as physicists say. That means that although it falls off as you separate charges, it falls off slowly, like inverse square law. That's pretty slow. Whereas the nuclear force is very short range. Nucleons, protons and neutrons, interact very strongly when they're 10 to the minus 13 centimeters apart. But if you take them a little farther apart, they do not interact at all. So it's a very short-range force. And Yukawa realized that if the nuclear force is short-range, this pion, this particle, this quanta that would be responsible for the force must be massive. It must weigh something. And so he predicted the existence of a new particle, and he predicted the mass. That was a remarkable prediction. It was the first prediction, really, of a new particle in that way. And a few years later, a new particle was discovered. Now, it happened to be the wrong particle. But it took another 11 years before that was figured out. And everyone was so convinced by that discovery that not only did he get the Nobel Prize, but everybody started working on the theory of the nuclear force based on mesons, forces provided by new fields and new kinds of quanta. Well, this was done in 1935, and then the war came along, and basic science stopped for a while. But after the war, with the new technology and the new support from governments that were very interested in nuclear physics, many new machines, microscopes, accelerators that accelerate particles and can do these kind of scattering experiments at even higher energy were built, and new detectors. And what they discovered was lots of new particles. This is one of the new kinds of detectors they had, a bubble chamber. By today's standards, this is unbelievably old-fashioned. And this is a picture of the results of what happens in one of these collisions. At this point, there was an event. Two protons collided, and a whole bunch of particles spewed out. And physicists learned how to look at these pictures and figure out from them what was going on. And what they started discovering were a host of new particles. So just when I was entering graduate school at the high energy conference at Switzerland, five new particles were reported. When I was a graduate student, every month there was a new particle being discovered. Particles called strange particles and hyperons and all sorts of particles. This is a time list of what's called the particle zoo. So you see how the pace picks up. The electron was discovered by J.J. Thomson at the end of the 19th century. And then the proton was really only discovered or identified as a constituent of the nucleus in 1919. Then it took another 12 years till Chadwick discovered the neutron. The next particle is the anti-electron, the positron that Paul Dirac predicted. And the next particle was thought originally to be Yukawa's pion, the quanta of the nuclear force. In fact, it turned out to be a copy, a heavy electron, a particle which was in all respects the same as the electron, but heavier. The second of the family of leptons, of which we now know there are three. The final member of this family of electron-like objects was discovered only about 10 years ago. The actual pion was only, Yukawa's pion was only discovered after the war, and then with the new detectors and accelerators, particles were being discovered, as I said, every day. The pion, the first of the strange, what were called the strange particles, hundreds of hadrons. By hadrons, one meant strongly interacting particles. All of these particles were similar to the proton and neutron. They had these strong nuclear forces. They had various properties. But There didn't seem to be anything special about the proton and the neutron except that they were discovered first. Well, this caused a big problem. So, where were we? The particle zoo. And all these particles. Now, what about the forces? Well, it was realized at this time, or before, that there really were two kinds of nuclear forces. One was the so-called weak interactions. They were responsible for radioactivity. They weren't actually so strong. They were weak. And they gave rise to the fact that, for example, the neutron outside of the nucleus in free space is unstable. And after about 10 minutes or so, decays to a proton, an electron, and a neutrino. That's an example of radioactivity. And there are many other kinds of radioactivity. Those were the weak interactions. And then there were the strong interactions, the real hard nuclear force, which was responsible for holding the nucleus together. Now, the weak interactions had a theory. There was a theory developed by Fermi, which was quite successful, phenomenological in spirit, but very successful for describing radioactivity. The strong interactions had this theory of Yukawa's based on mesons, meson field theory as opposed to electrodynamics. Both of them were based on the principles of quantum field theory that were developed for electrodynamics, for QED, and then applied to both of these other forces of nature. Quantum field theory, however, was in trouble. It was invented for quantum electrodynamics where it worked very well. There you had weak coupling, you could really do calculations, and you had a theory, Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, that you started with and then made quantum. But it had short distance infinities. And although a scheme called renormalization was invented by Schwinger and Feynman to deal with these infinities, it really was not understood, and it was thought to be a trick. It was regarded at the time that the way renormalization in QED dealt with these infinities was to sweep them under the rug, but they were really there, and they were going to cause trouble someday. And remarkably, Feynman, one of the inventors of this theory, as late as 61, said, "I still hold to this belief and do not subscribe to the philosophy of renormalization that he helped invent." The general feeling of the people who invented quantum field theory was that it was inadequate. Something was basically wrong about it. It was going to be replaced by some other revolutionary theory, the same way quantum mechanics replaced classical physics. This was especially true for the pioneering inventors of quantum field theory, who at the first drop of an infinity were ready to renounce their belief in the theory and wait for the next revolution. The Fermi theory, for example, was clearly sick at high energies. Everyone knew that, but high energies experimentally were away in the future, so they didn't worry too much. The much bigger problem were the strong interactions, the strong nuclear force. There, one had the problem of which particles are elementary. At the beginning, it was just the proton and neutron and Yukawa's pion. But then hundreds of other particles were discovered, and they all looked the same. So where do you start? And what is the theory? There was no theory, classical theory, or there was no principle to guide one as to how to couple these particles and invent a quantum field theory that described them. And finally, even if you could write down such a theory, and people, of course, wrote down lots of theories, you couldn't calculate anything because the couplings, the strength of the forces, were so big that all the methods that people had were uncontrollable. So you didn't know what to start with, you didn't know what the theory was, you couldn't calculate anything anyway, and people were pretty confused. And they all felt that a revolution was needed. Well, this is more or less when I come in. And let me epitomize the theoretical scene in the 60s, which I stepped into. And it was well described by Landau, the famous Soviet physicist, who said, "It is well known that theoretical physics of the present is almost helpless in dealing with the problem of the strong interactions. By now, the nullification of the theory," by which he meant these meson field theories, "is tacitly accepted, and even by theoretical physicists who profess to dispute it." Landau was very sure of himself. "This is evident from the complete disappearance of papers on meson theory, and particularly from Dyson, Freeman Dyson, the famous physicist who had contributed so much to QED, Dyson's assertion that the correct theory will not be found in the next 100 years. That was the feeling. Well, Dyson was wrong by about 87 years. Now, I was a student at Berkeley, and my advisor was Jeffrey Chu. Jeffrey Chu was known as the prophet of the bootstrap theory. His new approach was based on two ideas. First, the notion inherent in conventional field theory that certain particles are fundamental, whereas others are complex, like electrons are fundamental, but atoms are complex, is becoming less and less palatable for baryons and mesons as the number of candidates continues to increase. So, how do you deal with this increasing number of elementary particles? Well, what Chu said was, if you have so many elementary particles, then none of them are elementary. You have something he called, in the American spirit, nuclear democracy. All particles are equally fundamental. But then how do you construct a theory? Well, he also had objections to the basic concepts of quantum field theory that had been the tool until then, and invented something called the bootstrap. The bootstrap theory rested on two principles, which were both sort of more philosophic than scientific. One was the fact that there were all these particles and they all seemed equally good, so there are no elementary particles. Everyone is equally fundamental. And the second principle was that fields were not really observable. All you really observed in these experiments that people were carrying out were these scattering events. And that's what theorists should be calculating, scattering events, not the values of fields, which couldn't be measured anyway. And therefore, based on the principle that if it's not observable, it's meaningless, Chu concluded that fields were unphysical. But if there are no fields, there's no way to input dynamics. So there's no dynamics. Instead, you have a bootstrap. You assume very general principles that you have to believe in, like causality. And that should lead to a unique description of these scattering events, the so-called S matrix that describes the probabilities of these scattering events. In hindsight, it is clear that this bootstrap idea was born from the frustration of being unable to calculate anything using field theory. All models and approximations that were employed conflicted with some dearly held principle. If it was so difficult to construct a scattering matrix that was consistent with sacred principles, then maybe these general principles had a unique manifestation. It's an interesting way of thinking. And we now know it's totally wrong. But it had, at a place like Berkeley, where I was, incredible influence on all of us impressionable young graduate students. This was the revolution. This was the overthrow of the specific dynamical principles that had governed physics until now. Those of you who might have read a book called The Tao of Physics by Capra, popular account of physics, of nuclear physics, that was based on this bootstrap idea. And whatever else Kapra's ideas are, have to do with the relationship between physics and Buddhism, they shouldn't be based on this discredited idea. Well, my mentor at Princeton later on, Murph Goldberger, ex-president of Caltech, said, "My own feeling is that we've learned quite a deal from field theory. So I'm quite happy to discard it as an old but rather friendly mistress, who I'd be willing to recognize on the street if I should encounter her again." Remember, this is all a very politically incorrect time. From a philosophical point of view, however, the S-matrix approach seems to be the most attractive. So at this time in the United States, you really weren't supposed to work on field theory. It was simply not believed. The thing was even worse in the Soviet Union. There they discovered a certain property that was prevalent in quantum electrodynamics called screening. They understood that this was a property of all quantum field theories. In electrodynamics, screening is due to the fact that in a quantum mechanical system, the vacuum isn't exactly empty. It has virtual particles. And in quantum electrodynamics, there are virtual electrons and anti-electron pairs in the vacuum, and they screen the physical charge. So if you put a charge into a quantum mechanical vacuum, you get this screening, and the charge you actually see is reduced in magnitude. And the farther away you look at that charge, the smaller it seems to get because of this screening. It's called vacuum polarization. So as you go to larger distances, the charge decreases. And as you conversely probe the structure of, say, the nucleon, the proton, at short distances, the electric charge gets bigger and bigger. The force is stronger at short distances. And what the Russian group discovered was that this happens in all field theories they looked at, and in fact it gets infinitely strong at short distance. So infinitely strong that the theory seemed to be totally inconsistent. And this was true for all known theories, and Landau reached the conclusion that within the limits of formal electrodynamics and all these other theories, you couldn't have any interaction at all. We're driven, therefore, to the conclusion that the Hamiltonian method, this is the time-honored field-theoretic method of treating things for strong interactions, is dead and must be buried, although, of course, with deserved honor. And in the Soviet Union, this had even a bigger impact than in the States. Because in the States, we have a little bit of intellectual freedom. Whereas in the Soviet Union, when Landau decreed this, his graduate students and all graduate students were really forbidden to work on field theory. My friends who survived only did so because they were working in parallel fields. Well, if one couldn't do dynamics and one couldn't do field theory, what could one do at that time? What was being done was to look for patterns and symmetries of the hadrons. These patterns are independent of the dynamics, and symmetry principles perhaps are independent of the underlying dynamics. And important things were discovered at that period. It looked like hadrons were made out of quarks, as Gell-Mann and Zweig discovered. It looked, in fact, like baryons, like the neutron and proton, were made out of three objects, and mesons were made out of two objects, quarks and antiquarks. These quarks came in three different kinds, different flavors they were called, up, down, and strange. Three more have been discovered by now. We now think there are 6 quarks. So baryons, nucleons, and mesons looked like they were made out of these objects. That could explain something about the patterns of all these families of particles and the symmetries between them. They also, it was discovered, looked like there were 3 different kinds of each flavor of quark. Quarks came in 3 identical colors. This was discovered in a much more roundabout way. The patterns of hadrons looked like they were made out of quarks, but you had problems with sort of fundamental principles of quantum mechanics unless you assumed there were 3 different kinds of colors, which behaved in identical fashions. But nobody really believed in these quarks. You couldn't see quarks directly. If you smashed the hadrons together, quarks never came out. It wasn't like an atom where when you smashed it, out came the electrons, or a nucleus when you smashed it, out came the neutrons and protons. Nobody had ever seen, and has never seen to date, and will never see, a quark, free quark. So therefore people said, well, these quarks aren't real, they're just useful mathematical devices for understanding these patterns and symmetries. And so you were allowed to pretend that there were these quarks for the purposes of establishing these patterns, but not to believe in them. As late as 1972, 1 year before everything was clear, by the way, Murray Gell-Mann said at the end of summary talk at the big conference at Fermilab, "Let us end by emphasizing our main point. It may well be possible to construct an explicit theory of hadrons based on quarks and some kind of glue, something to hold the quarks together, treated as fictitious, but with enough physical properties abstracted and applied to real hadrons to constitute a complete theory." So this again was a point of view. There really isn't any dynamics. You abstract certain principles in place of a real theory, and you build it on these objects, quarks, that have no real existence. Well, in fact, Gell-Mann was the leading proponent of something called the method of abstraction. This was a way of getting results that you could test with experiment, the goal of physics, of theoretical physics. In order to obtain such relations that we conjecture to be true, we use the method of abstraction. So we construct a mathematical theory of the strongly interacting particles, which may or may not have anything to do with reality. Doesn't matter. Find suitable relations that hold, postulate their validity, and then throw away the model. We may compare this process to a method sometimes employed in French cuisine. A piece of pheasant meat is cooked between 2 slices of veal, which are then discarded. Well, this paper made quite an impression, especially on an impoverished graduate student like me, who could only dream of eating such a meal. It was a marvelous approach. You see, it gave you the freedom to play with the forbidden fruit of field theory, abstract from it what one wanted, without having to believe in the theory. The only problem, of course, was what was the principle that guided you to abstract which part of the theory? Anyway, this attitude towards quarks and the underlying dynamical theory persisted until 1973, and even beyond in some people's minds. Quarks didn't exist as real particles, therefore they were fictitious. You could use them to extract various properties, but you didn't really believe in the models very seriously. For many, this smelled very fishy. I remember very well Steven Weinberg, who was by that time already a famous physicist, reaction to some of the relations that I had derived with my colleague Callan using the quark model. And I described my work to Weinberg at a dinner of the junior fellows at Harvard, where I was by then. And I needed him to write a letter of recommendation for me to Princeton, where I was applying for an assistant professorship. So I was a little nervous, and I explained to him my results that I had gotten and how they seemed to be in agreement with the ongoing experiments at SLAC, at Stanford. And Weinberg was emphatic that this was absolutely no interest to him because he didn't believe in anything about quarks. Well, I was a bit shattered, but I still got the job. He must have written a good letter. Well, so leaving Berkeley and escaping from the bootstrap, I went to Harvard, where it was people were a little freer to indulge in things like this method of abstraction, and I employed it with my colleague, Kurt Callan, and we derived some rules using new methods for a new class of experiments that were just underway. These sum rules were derived from the quark model, which actually in today's term seems absurdly naive. We took a model of quarks interacting in some way and treated them in a totally cavalier and later we understood totally incorrect fashion. But the spirit of the times was that the main thing was to get these relations, sum rules, and test them. And these could be tested in these new experiments that were soon to be underway at the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and which was going to probe the short distance structure of electrons in the same way, roughly, that Rutherford probed the structure of the atom, this time by scattering electrons off protons and measuring, looking at what came out. These experiments that came out shortly after our sum rules discovered, in fact, something which was totally surprising to everyone, point-like behavior. It was the Rutherford story all over again. Everybody expected that the proton, which had always shown every sign of being a biggish, smoothest, complicated object, would give rise to complicated, smooth, cross-sections. Instead, they discovered point-like behavior. They discovered that these events looked as if the proton was made out of points, point-like constituents. Once again, there was structure and it was point-like. Nobody expected that. They also discovered that our sum rules worked. Now, of course, although we weren't clever enough to realize that, our sum rules led to point-like behavior. Because we treated things as if they were essentially non-interacting, there were no strong forces. We were very naive, and this is naive point-like behavior. The sum rules actually worked. The constituents, these events, looked as if the point-like particles behaved like quarks. Well, that was very exciting. First of all, there's nothing, as a theorist, as a theoretical scientist, like having a prediction that you've made verified. It's the biggest rush you can get. And this was verified very rapidly. And so I derived a lot more sum rules that were also tested at SLAC and at CERN, and they too worked. All the indications were that the proton looked as if it was made out of quarks, but now not just patterns and symmetries, but real dynamical properties. And these experiments continued to show this over the next few years, and they, in the success of these sum rules, convinced me that hadrons were made out of point-like constituents, and that these constituents were quarks. Quarks were real. But how could that be? First of all, quarks must interact very strongly, because you can never produce them, it seems. No matter how hard you hit the nucleons, quarks never came out. So they had to be held together very strongly. So they had to interact very strongly. But this point-like behavior seemed to be destroyed by quantum effects. And if the quantum effects are strong, you lose this scaling, this point-like behavior immediately, as well as my beloved sum rules. So here we had a real paradox, total conflict between all of these concepts. Now, in those years, I took some time off to work on what was another potential revolution called string theory. That's how string theory was born, another revolutionary attempt to understand the behavior of the nuclear force. It led elsewhere, as you know. And in fact, at that time, it appeared that no string theory could explain this point-like behavior, because strings were very soft objects. Well, by 1972, I was in Princeton already, and I'd learned enough field theory, and there had been enough other theoretical developments of great importance, that I had decided on a definite plan to kill quantum field theory once and for all. I decided quite deliberately to prove that quantum field theory could not explain this point-like behavior, and therefore was not an appropriate framework for the description of the strong interactions, at least settle this issue to the validity of quantum field theory. And the idea was based on proving that this scaling, this point-like behavior, required something which we later called asymptotic freedom, namely that you have a theory where all the forces actually turn off at short distances. If all the forces vanish at high energies or short distances, then you have no interactions, nothing violates this point-like behavior of the elementary particles. And Callan and I proved that in 1973. And the second part of the plan was to prove that there are no asymptotically free theories, field theories. And Coleman and I more or less proved that about the same time. And together, this would prove that if you take the experiment, the scaling, then there are no field theories that satisfy this condition, so field theory's out. That was my plan. Now, there was one exception to this second line of argument. That was non-abelian gauge theories, Yang-Mills theories. And so with my student, Frank Wilczek, who had started to work with me, we decided to complete the argument and kill quantum field theory once and for all. Well, what we discovered, in fact, was quite different. Let me say a word about non-abelian gauge theories. Electrodynamics is a gauge theory. You have charges. The force arises from photons that are exchanged between these charged particles. There's only one kind of charge, and there's only one quanta of the field, one photon, one light ray. Non-abelian gauge theories have many charges. Let's say three, because that's what's appropriate for the nuclear force. Red, white, and blue. Give them names, different kinds of charges. And they can turn into one another by exchanging a gluon. So now you have a force. These gluons actually have 3 times 3 equals 8 by the magic of group theory, kinds of gluons, which enable a white charge to turn into a red charge as it interacts with another white, or actually an anti-white charge that turns into an anti-red charge. Electrodynamics is simple because photons are neutral. They don't carry any charge themselves. Light is neutral. And so photons don't interact. Gluons, on the other hand, have 2 of these colors. They themselves are colored, are charged, and they can interact. Here you have a gluon hitting a gluon, a red-white gluon hitting a blue-red gluon, and scattering. This is a much harder theory because of this fact. It is nonlinear. The photons, the light of a non-abelian gauge theory interacts with itself. So it's a different kind of theory, and one of the main differences, and for us the crucial difference, is that photons are neutral, whereas gluons, the photons of the non-abelian theory, are charged themselves. And so they contribute to vacuum polarization. they contribute to the screening and overcome it in the opposite direction. So what we discovered and published was the discovery that these theories, which had been of great interest in the last few, in the years preceding, as theories of the weak interactions, which I don't have time to describe, also have the remarkable property, perhaps unique, of asymptotically approaching free field theory, of becoming non-interacting at short distances. That's exactly what we needed to explain this scaling. And therefore, we could use that as a theory of scaling. Now, why is that the case? Well, you remember I told you that QED electrodynamics reduces the charge at large distances because of screening. In a non-abelian gauge theory, where you have in the vacuum virtual gluons, virtual excitations of not just the charged particles, like the electron or the quark, but also the gluons, the carriers of the force, they actually behave like little magnets. And the situation can be best understood by what happens in such a medium when you put a magnet, these other little magnets that are in the vacuum align in the same direction, and what you see from far away is a bigger magnet, because they all add up. So the force gets bigger at large distances, and conversely, smaller at short distances. The fact that this force turns off at short distance is what we call asymptotic freedom. The fact that the force gets larger at large distances led us to suggest that this phenomena called infrared slavery could be responsible for holding the quarks together. The quarks, when they're close together, are hardly interacting. That's asymptotic freedom. When they're far apart, are very strongly interacting, so they can never be torn apart. Well, so that's what we, just a reiteration of what we said in that first paper. For me, the discovery of asymptotic freedom was totally unexpected. I was trying to prove that it was impossible in field theory. So it's sort of like an atheist who gets a message from a burning bush. I became immediately a true believer. Field theory wasn't wrong. Instead, scaling must be explained by an asymptotically free non-abelian gauge theory. There was only one theory that could do it. That's what we managed putting all this together. And that theory was sort of obvious. The dynamics was governed. It had to be a non-abelian gauge theory where you had gluons. What could they couple to? Well, the only charges, the charged matter, we knew already from these various sum rules and the patterns, consisted of quarks, which carried three colors. They were identical. So these were obviously the charges to which the gluons of the gauge theory coupled that gave the force. We knew the constituents. We knew everything. As we said in our first paper, one particularly appealing model is based on three triplets of fermions to provide the strong interactions with an SU3 color gauge group. And in such a theory, we recover the sum rules with small corrections. QCD. And furthermore, we had a mechanism to understand this crazy thing that no matter how hard you hit the nucleon, the quarks could never come out, confinement. That was simply because the force got stronger and stronger the farther you tried to separate the quarks. Well, the theoretical acceptance of QCD was sort of immediate for a small group of physicists. For me, it was clear that this had to work, but there were many, many problems. The experimental situation, of course, was far from clear, and the issue of confinement was a conceptual puzzle that was pretty bizarre at that time. However, within this small group of theorists, the acceptance of the theory was remarkably rapid. Sometimes in physics it takes years for new ideas to percolate into the collective consciousness, but in some rare cases there is a change of perception that is somewhat analogous to a phase transition. Water goes to ice. It was suddenly clear that such a theory, this QCD, was consistent with everything we knew to be true about the strong interactions. It could contain within it all the successful phenomenology that had been developed and explain this totally mysterious phenomena of scaling and maybe even confinement. So among a certain group, it was accepted immediately. One of the reasons they accepted it is you could calculate. Physicists love to calculate. An idea to win in physics has to be one that allows you to do calculations. Then young people start calculating, and it gets accepted. It also we began to develop over the next few years a gradual qualitative understanding of confinement. One way of thinking about it is that when you have the quarks close together, the forces are weak, and you get the usual kind of behavior you get in electrodynamics, where the force falls off like an inverse square law, and the energy between these quarks falls off with distance. But when you take them apart, the properties of this anti-screening vacuum are such as to force the field lines to a little narrow tube that connects the two quarks, quark or anti-quark, and that gives rise to an energy between them that increases linearly and makes it impossible with any amount of energy to separate them. However, even today, the solution of quantum chromodynamics at low energies remains elusive. And it is still one of the open problems that the KITP will be running workshops on, perhaps for decades or centuries to come. We are utterly convinced, however, that the theory is right. At the theoretical level, we have brute force numerical techniques based on lattice that allow you to calculate the properties of the nucleons, the hadrons, directly. And the hope among some of us that string theory will eventually be useful, actually, as a way of getting an analytic solution of the theory. Because hadrons do look a bit like strings. That's why string theory was discovered in that way, where these strings are really color flux tubes. What about the experimental confirmation of the theory? Well, the original motivation for the theory were these scaling experiments, and QCD predicted very small corrections to that. And they began to appear in the middle 70s, but it took really years for them to be quantitatively confirmed. The most dramatic confirmation came in early 1975 at the new electron-positron accelerator at SLAC, where if you measure now the probability that electron and positron, when they collide, annihilate into hadrons, compared to that where they annihilate into electron-positron again, you essentially measure the number of quarks. In QCD, where this is point-like, this ratio is simply counts how many quarks you have. And we had predictions. We knew how many quarks there were. And one of the things that convinced us that early on that the theory was right was that this ratio was exactly what it should be for three quarks. And I remember very well in 1974 giving one of the first lectures I gave on asymptotic freedom in QCD at Trieste. And Bert Richter, who was running this experiment, measuring these annihilations at SLAC, was there. And he got up and said, nope, QCD is dead. He said, I'm blowing up the curve. But the resolution isn't so good. This is the prediction. But look at this. It's taking off. And he was never so happy. Experimentalists love to shoot down theorists. This wasn't a very established theory. It'd only been around for a year or so. Well, some of us said, you know, we have lots of reasons, for other reasons having to do with the weak interactions, to believe that there is a fourth quark. Maybe what you're seeing is the threshold for producing this new quark. And he said, ah, theorists always have an explanation. Well, a few months later, lo and behold, they discovered a remarkable resonance. You see this peak? Which was shortly understood to be a new kind of state made out of a new kind of quark and the antiquark. And in fact, they discovered, indeed, a new quark. And as they pushed on, the thing settled down again to a constant that was exactly what you'd expect with four quarks. And this is the compilation over the next 30 years. This one graph represents untold man hours, millions of dollars. This is another quark that was discovered. This is the agreement with the theory. This is the Z boson, the quanta of the weak force, which is a massive short-ranged force. So over the years, with new accelerators and beautiful experiments, the tests of this theory have gradually improved at places like CERN or Fermilab or SLAC. This is, the accelerators have gotten bigger. They now straddle countries, not just hilltops in Berkeley. This is the CERN accelerator, the sign of the site of electron, the electron-positron accelerator, and the coming Large Hadron Collider. You see, this is Geneva Airport. This is the accelerator. This is Switzerland. This is France. Big things, and they're needed. One of the things that finally has been verified with great precision are the very small violations of scaling that we could calculate immediately. These lines, if this point-like behavior were exact, the scaling were exact, would be exactly straight. There'd be no variation with this thing, Q squared. But they're not exactly straight, and these are the fits to the theory, which is a no-parameter fit. But you need a lot of decades of energy. These experiments have been slow since the violations, the effects of this violations are very small, logarithmic. What about the actual running of the coupling, the fact that the strong interaction alpha, the strength of the strong interactions of the nuclear fourth, decreases with energy? Well, this is one of the latest measures of that. You see, it goes to zero slowly, and therefore took a long time to really verify. These are verifications, measurements of this one coupling in many, many, many different ways. And they're all consistent with this black curve, which is the prediction that came from asymptotic freedom. What about another way of asking about QCD? Can all the effects of the strong interactions, as measured at least at short distances where we understand the theory well and can calculate because things are weak, be described by one single coupling, by one number? And this is an example of that agreement. Here you have many different experiments and a calculation, an ab initio calculation, and this is the one parameter they're measuring, or described in terms of? And the answer is resoundingly yes, and this is the value, if you want, of this coupling to about 1% accuracy. And finally, we are able to calculate the mass spectrum of the proton and the neutron and the pion and all those elementary particles starting from the theory with very little input. One or two numbers, the masses of the quarks. The best calculation is one done by my colleague and his group, Bob Sugar, and the MLIC collaboration. They did a calculation where they put the world on a lattice of points, makes life easier, because there are only a finite number of points. 2 million points to describe all of space and time. Took them 100 gigaflop years of calculation. That's one PC work, one really heavy PC working for 100 years. And this is the mass spectrum they get. These are some of the low-lying hadrons, the pion, the proton, one of the proton excitations, some of the other, kaon. These are the masses. The black curves are the experimental numbers, and these blue things are the theoretical calculations without all the error bars drawn, Bob tells me. But this is incredible precision at this point in time. And it's taken 25 years and unbelievable effort. Someday we would hope to replace this by an analytic back of the envelope calculation. Well, what were the implications of this asymptotic freedom property of QCD that we discovered? Well, most important was that it led to QCD and predicted, you know, contained both of its essential features, namely, at very high energies, very weak strength of force, where so you get point-like behavior with small violations, and at very low energies, you get very strong forces that confine the quarks. But there are other implications. Some of them have to do with this quantum field theory. QCD and asymptotic freedom really resolve a lot of the problems that made people so suspicious of quantum field theory. There were all these infinities. QCD has no infinities. Instead of this coupling, like in QED, becoming infinite at short distances, it actually vanishes. And if you do things right, like the people on the lattice do, when they have to put it on a computer, you never encounter infinity at all. There are no ultraviolet divergences. Furthermore, it's in some sense a perfect theory. It has no adjustable parameters. There are these quark masses, but they're so small that you get a good approximation to QCD if you neglect them, set them equal to zero. And then, in a sense, all observables in QCD are calculable in terms of one mass scale. You need something to measure masses in terms of. It's a remarkable theory with essentially no free parameters. And furthermore, there are no diseases in this theory at high energies. Every theory we had until this broke down if you extrapolated it to higher and higher energy. Something bad happened at short distances. Even classical electrodynamics has the self-energy problem. But at QCD, because of asymptotic freedom, things get simpler and better behaved and more understood at high energies. And so, in fact, QCD is a theory where you can extrapolate the theory to infinitely high energies. It has no adjustable parameters, no infinities. It's a perfect theory. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it doesn't describe the universe. There are other forces. And lucky for us, or we wouldn't be here. And finally, this property of the strong interactions, that they fall off and go to zero, vanish at high energies, removes the barrier to unification of all the forces. Shortly after the QCD came along, and also a story which I haven't told you anything about, the electroweak theory, also a gauge theory, non-abelian gauge theory, people extrapolated. These forces change with distance because of this polarization, the strong force, which is so much stronger than the weak and electromagnetic forces at low energies, where we now observe, converges with the others to the same strength at a very high energy. And this picture has, since the middle 70s, provided our strongest guide to the future. It's motivated not just particle physics, but even cosmology in the belief that we can really think about extending our reach of physics at least to this extraordinarily high energy, something necessary to do if you're going to describe the beginning of the universe. For particle physics, it's told us where the next new physics is going to lie. And it happens to lie where gravity becomes important. So we believe that the next new realm, the next threshold, will be one in which these forces are all equally strength, equal in strength, and gravity is equal in importance. And of course, as you all know, that's string theory. But that's for another day. Thank you. Me or Fred?
Okay, we may take some questions, but maybe it's just a breath to answer.
Thank you, David.
Three, four, three colors.
Right. It's 3 × 3−1 for the U1 of U3. There's one combination of 3 × 3 that doesn't couple, can be removed, and is. In the simplest theory. You could add it in 2, but you don't need it, and it isn't there. John?
Just a thought I wanted to do, but Einstein's treatment of gravity is a special relationship with the structure of space. And I was wondering if anything in your work.
No. Well, that's a good question. The era I was describing, 62 to 73, students of my ilk who were interested in elementary particle physics, that was where the frontier was. Then there were these people doing relativity, general relativity, and they were we thought of them as doing mathematical physics, something that was totally inaccessible to experiment and of absolutely no relevance to us. And we were, of course, totally right and totally wrong. So we were right because the basic forces that govern the atom and the nucleus have nothing to do at these low energy scales with gravity. And they are forces like electricity and magnetism for describing such particles and the forces you imagine that you're in a fixed space-time. And that's a very good approximation because gravity is so weak that you see even you don't distort the space-time metric very much. It takes a big planet or a black hole to do that. And you don't have those objects around us in the lab. However, as we saw, or as I said, in these pictures, the lesson here is, somebody turn off the thing, that when you go, if you look at very low energy, look at very short distances, you will see, if you want virtual particles, which are interacting as strongly gravitationally as they would by electricity and magnetism and strong and weak forces. Which leads us to believe that all of those forces are just different manifestations of the same thing, as exemplified by string theory. But when you look at the objects at reasonable distances, 20 orders of magnitude, 10 to the 20 times bigger, they look differently, very different. That's this phenomena that things look different at different scales, that the forces change in magnitude as you look at the object at different scales. So, we were right. You could ignore gravity completely in figuring out the laws of atoms and solids and nuclei and everything, and still can as far as ongoing experiments go. But if you want to understand what goes on at arbitrarily high energies, arbitrarily short distances, and presumably what underlies it all, you're going to have to include the dynamics of space-time called gravity. John?
Any lessons for young scientists from your experience? In particular, was there any one thing
Well, I was actually pretty lucky. I can mostly see the faults of some of my contemporaries at this time. There are a lot of lessons. Unfortunately, the lessons you learn never apply to the future. That's the problem with history. I tried to give you the picture of how people were stumbling around and had lots of misconceptions and wrong ideas. That's totally normal in physics. So one lesson I've learned is that we're likely to be stumbling around when one has lots of misconceptions. For me, it was very important to follow the data. I had an enormous belief in those crucial experiments at STAC where most of my contemporaries thought they were epiphenomena. Now, partly I believed them because they confirmed my predictions. But also, I was taught very well by my advisor, the bootstrap prophet, who taught me one thing very important was to take experiment seriously. And don't let the obvious lessons of observation be distorted by your theoretical prejudices. So that served me very well. Unfortunately, in my present pursuit in string theory, that lesson is sort of useless because we don't have any direct experimental clue, or very few. So there are a lot of other lessons I could spat out, but they wouldn't probably be useful for the problems we face today.
Do you ever have moments of doubt about the methodology of science?
No. I'm not sure what you mean by that. I described to you a great example of the application of science which allowed us to evolve from farce to triumph. It's pretty good. Now, by and large, my experience is that we've achieved, at least in elementary particle physics, and more than I had any dreams of at the time. I mean, when I was a grad student, this was this feeling, it would be 100 years before you had something and it would require a total revolution, et cetera, et cetera. The idea that one would have gotten so far and so completely in such a short time would have been preposterous. So how can I have doubts in the mythology of science?
Is there any reason to predict that there will be no more quarks discovered there? Is there any reason to doubt that there's more quarks in space?
There are reasons, but they're a little bit complicated to explain. The quarks come in families, two by two by two. Those go along with these leptons, electron, the muon, and the next tau family of leptons. So every time, if we, within the standard theory, the strong interactions, the weak interactions, all put together, the standard model of particle physics, if you were to discover a new quark, it would have to be two new quarks, and it would have to be another lepton, another electron, and another neutrino. And there are, from cosmology and direct measurement, very strong limitations on the number of neutrinos, because neutrinos are so light that we could see them already. So indirectly, there are very strong constraints on, if you believe that a quark, this line of argument always goes together with a very light neutrino, there can't be any more quarks. On the other hand, maybe the neutrinos that go along with this new quark happen to be too heavy to observe at the moment, then there are no limitations. And it's only a theory like string theory that has the potential, we think, for explaining why there are three quarks, or four, or any particular number of quarks.
Well, David, we all share a sense of tremendous, tremendous excitement. Let's go to the reception to celebrate.